Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hi there, Marky.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm feeling snappy.
I actually had, we had lobster for dinner last night.
Mm-hmm.
And then, look, lobster's in the news.
Lobster's all over the news today, as a matter of fact. So, yeah, some people up in Maine a little bit upset about people putting faux lobster into their food.
Yeah, yeah. Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine is addressing the issue. You have the word lobster. Well, see, words have meaning, everyone. And it seems as though a number of companies are using the word lobster when they really mean langostino, which is kind of like a shrimp that's a lot less expensive.
And generally less expensive. There are some really cool langoustines from around the world which are spectacular, but that's not the ones we're talking about today.
And what's happened is there's a 2-inch shellfish known as a langostino or langostino lobster. It's not really a lobster, and Senator Snowe is asking the Food and Drug Administration to yank approval, which it's given, for restaurants to market the product as lobster on their menu. And she also doesn't want it to say langostino lobster.
Mm.
She writes to the FDA commissioner, langostino is not lobster, nor should it be marketed as such.
Well, Maine, especially Maine lobsters, they do so much in conservation, okay? There's so much that they're doing to, you know, between, they do the little V-notching if they find a pregnant female to make sure if they find a prolific female
an egg-bearing female continues to bear eggs.
Doesn't get caught and kept. That people know that it's a egg-bearing female. If they catch a lobster that's 6 pounds or more, they throw it back because again, those are some of the most prolific lobsters in the sea or the ocean.
Well, but these are very expensive, and therefore, mm-hmm. you know, lobsters cost money. But if you can, you know, if I call a langostino lobster, can I call a shrimp lobster?
Well, but we do it in other areas of food. We call, you know, chicken nuggets, we call them chicken, you know.
But they're made of chicken.
Just barely.
That's funny. But no, so here's, like, Long John Silver's has introduced, and this is a quote, buttered lobster bites last mm-hmm. year, which were made with, quote-unquote, langostino lobsters. The chain marketed the limited-time seafood as being for people who crave the taste of lobsters, but they don't have $20 to spend. And what that should, I want to add on to that tagline, for people who crave the taste of lobster but don't have the $20 to spend, so want to pretend something that's not lobster is lobster, and we'll tell you the lie.
I mean, how many times have you seen on a menu somewhere, somehow, it says lobster salad or crab salad, and it's sea legs? You know, to me, that's just reprehensible.
Yeah.
First of all, I find sea legs to be one of the grossest foods on the planet. But, you know, they take other pieces of scrap fish and they paint little red stripes on them so that they'll look like pieces of lobster. Some of the most disgusting food
on the
planet.
Think of it as the sawdust of the seafood world that they combine together into the press board of the seafood
and
world.
And they want you to buy it as sea legs. And so, you know, anytime you sell me lobster, make it lobster. If you want to sell me langoustines, sell me langoustines. You want to sell me shrimp or crab or whatever, sell me those things and don't try and mask something else as another thing, because I really have no patience for
that.
I'm going to scold you for it on the air if you do it.
We're with Senator Snowe on this one. Langostino lobster, not really lobster, be aware. More lobster news today.
It's a big lobster day here.
We have Frank Bruni is the New York Times restaurant critic, and he has a blog, and we follow his blog every once in a while. And he writes, both in public, there's a lot of controversy these days about whether it's humane or not to keep lobsters in a tank, whether it's humane or not to boil a lobster alive. Cut it out. A lobster's a bug, okay? It's an arthropod, okay?
Yeah,
it's a bug. And you step on bugs, and if you step on bugs, you shouldn't have a problem killing a lobster. Now, if you have a little squeamish about boiling a lobster alive, and everybody says, oh, the lobster screams when you put it in the pot. No, it doesn't scream. The air escapes through the shell, and that makes a whistling sound sometimes. But listen, if the way to kill a lobster, the way we do it in the restaurant, you take a knife. When it comes time, you blindfold the lobster, you give it a last cigarette, and then you cut the knife down right in its head. You split its head front to back, just whoosh, whoosh, and the lobster's dead. Okay,
and
very painless.
By the back of the head, you put a knife in, and you just flatten the knife out across the lobster's head, and it's done. Lobster feels nothing. And you put your lobster in the pot, and it's so much more humane than most of the way we kill other animals.
Well, you could give the lobster a last meal of what do lobsters eat?
Sardines.
So, but then you'd have to humanely put the sardine to sleep so it wouldn't be hurt when the lobster killed the sardine. Crazy people. Okay. But this is from Frank Bruni. I've heard from many readers, including one who advocated a rather unusual method for trying to diminish whatever pain the lobster might feel in a pot of boiling water. Hypnotize the lobster first.
This is way, I don't know if you guys remember, we talked about a thing called the Crusta Stun. That's where you put the, it's a $4,000 machine that you put your lobster into, electrocute it to death.
Rather than boil it to death. I think that we should worry about people in the world suffering too much pain and stop with this.
Go ahead.
Okay. It's done this way, the reader writes. You place the lobster at eye level. I do it by holding the lobster on the kitchen counter with my hand well behind its flailing claws. Then I stoop until I'm at eye level with the lobster. With my eyes 6 to 8 inches from the lobster's eyes, the reader continued, I stare intently into those protruding black orbs. It only takes a few minutes of steady staring until flailing claws subside and are resting quietly on the counter. The lobster is now still.
Same thing used to happen to a kid in second grade. I used to do that, too. I'd just stare and stare, and then all of a sudden he'd be still. He wouldn't move.
And you go,
an inch.
Yeah, okay. Actually,
You know what? I got a watch, too. I use the watch sometimes, a candle. You can use any of these things.
The same thing happens if you rub the lobster's head back to forth. It will actually kind of make it immobile. I don't know why petting a lobster makes it immobile, but... Well, there you have it.
But one of the things I love at the end of this article is he talks to... some lobster experts. Bruni talks to some lobster experts, and one of the things he said is, yeah, you actually do hypnotize the lobster, but there are some people who believe that actually the lobster is then, after you put it in the boiling water, actually is alive for longer in the hypnotic state than it would be if it weren't in the hypnotic state.
So,
you doing the lobster any favors?
It's a bug, okay? It's a lobster. I can't even believe it.
It is a delicious bug, though, you have to admit.
We work so hard in our restaurants and on this show to talk about... There are some ways that people are being really cruel to animals out there. And if you go to Humane Farm Animal Care, or you look on our website for some of the back shows, you'll see some of the practices that we're against and we work against. But you know, stop worrying about if the lobster feels pain when you put a knife through its head.
Especially when it's 1 second. I mean, it's like I said, the way we butcher most of our animals in this country, it doesn't happen that way.
And it certainly dies a much happier death with you with a knife through its head than it dies in the ocean when something out there gets it. Because what eats a lobster?
I love
cod?
That. A wolf, fish, cod.
The cod doesn't put it to sleep before it eats its head off. You know what
and
I'm saying?
It almost never puts a knife through its brain instantaneously.
It sort of eats its entrails as it watches it happen. You know what I mean? What's wrong with these people?
Yeah, well.
I don't quite get it, but I do love
lobster. What's wrong
with
these wolffish, these evil, vile wolffish? I think we should eat all the wolffish so they leave the lobsters alone.
But do it humanely.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all right, enough of this ridiculousness. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is Gary Regan. He's the author of The Joy of Mixology, The Consummate Guide to the Bartender's Craft. He's the author of the column The Cocktailian in the San Francisco Chronicle. He's a frequent contributor to The Wine Enthusiast, The Malt Advocate, Cheers Magazine, and he's also the creator of a bartending course called Cocktails in the Country, and we've actually sent a couple of our bartenders to Cocktails in the Country from Catherine Lombardi, and he's joining us today to talk about cocktails in general and this cool new class he's got going on. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you doing, guys?
Hey, Gary, we're doing pretty well.
Oh, good.
Now, Gary, before we talk about cocktails, well, let's talk about cocktails in the country. You've developed this class, and you've developed it on two levels, one for consumers and one for professionals. And we sent a couple of our bartenders. First of all, you can tell us on the air, how did they do? Did they pass? Was it worth it?
They were the best bartenders I've ever had in a class.
Are you serious?
No.
No.
But that's okay. They appreciate that.
But seriously, they were really good. I get all levels of bartenders. The guys you sent me were fairly experienced, and they knew what they were doing. And it's always interesting when you put a bunch of bartenders together of varying levels.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes in a class we'll have bartenders from Pegu Club or Flatiron Lounge, or maybe, Absinthe in San Francisco, and then you'll get, and they could have been doing it for years.
These are some of the top cocktail joints in the country.
Yeah, and then you'll get a couple of bartenders from, some airport hotel who've only been tending bar for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing because sometimes it's the newcomers that end up teaching the more seasoned guys. Every now and again, they'll come up with things like, oh, why are you doing it that way? Mm-hmm. Why don't you do it this way?
Well, maybe they're a little more open-minded, a little fresh,
fresh
eyes sometimes.
Maybe, and of course, that doesn't happen all the time. Most of the time, it's the seasoned pros who are leading the way. But it does happen, so it's always interesting to see that.
So let's talk about what Cocktails in the Country is exactly.
It's a two-day workshop, and originally I did a mix of consumers and bartenders. But this year, for the first year, I made it for bartenders only, or what I really should say is for hospitality industry professionals only.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause we do have beverage managers or bar owners and various other people.
Now, when you say this is a two-day seminar, you actually send people, come from New York City or wherever, and they take a car, they go up in a car out in the country and spend 2 days, they stay overnight, and really do an intensive seminar on cocktails. What gave you the idea to start this intensively, and how's it been received?
Well, the idea came, it was born out of this deep-seated desire I had to make some money. And our local inn, and I know these guys really well, they have a private bar that seats 12 people, and they very rarely used it. And I kept looking at this bar, and the room, we can put about 30 people at tables, and I kept looking at it thinking, we can use this bar for something. And I'd written a few articles about what it takes to be a bartender. And as we all know, it takes a heck of a lot more than being able to make a drink.
Well, you got to be able to throw a bum out, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. And how to handle the boss and all those good things. And I thought, I wonder if I could put a little course together about that. And bring people up from the city. So this was in 2001 I started doing it. And it immediately got tremendous support from the liquor industry. So I got sponsorship dollars from many major liquor companies that made it possible for me to offer the course for next to nothing to the bartenders.
Now, I think we want to point out to people that, there are bartending schools we hear advertised. We get people who apply for a job from bartending schools, and they learn how to mix with colored liquors, a gin and tonic, a fuzzy navel, a fuzzy
Long Island iced tea.
That's not what we're talking about, right, Gary?
No, we do nothing like that. We use all regular liquors and liqueurs and vermouths and aperitif wines. We use all fresh juices. We don't really spend a great deal of time going into how to make a fuzzy navel. We do a little bit of methodology. We do quite a lot on bartender philosophy, on what it takes to be a bartender, and what it means to be a bartender.
Do you see a barman as or a bartender as a sort of a locus of community? Do you think that's important?
Absolutely. A bartender, when you step behind the bar, I call this the power of the mahogany. When you step behind the bar, you are given by your customers a tremendous amount of power. Everybody looks on the bartender as an authority figure. And that power is handed to you by the customers.
We're going to come back and talk about the power of the mahogany, which is a colloquialism I'm going to adopt, with Gary Regan, who's one of the top authors on cocktails in the country. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Ring in 2007 at just such a gathering with us. The Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally, she's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn, and on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance, one of the best jazz singers in the country, two of the best restaurants in the state, an evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or Catherine Lombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is author Gary Regan, cocktail instructor Gary Regan, and we were talking just before the break about how the bartender, and Gary teaches a lot. He teaches at Cocktails in the Country. So if you're in the business, you want to go to ardentspirits.com or our website, restaurantguysradio.com, to find out more about this amazing course. We've sent our bartenders, and we'll send more of our bartenders. But you were talking about the power of the mahogany, which is the respect that a bartender has and the unique social position that a bartender has in an establishment and maybe in a community. You want to finish your thoughts on that, Gary?
Yeah, sure. So the customers give you that power as soon as you walk behind the bar, and it's very important to know how to use it. And as far as I'm concerned, the main job of a bartender is to take that opportunity to make people feel a little bit better when they leave the bar than they did when they walked in.
And you're not just talking about pumping them with a couple of pumps.
No, that's not what I'm talking
no,
about.
Exactly.
I'm talking about being able to listen to your customers, being able to figure out what you can do to change their day, if only in a minute way. It doesn't matter how small it is. If you can make people feel better, then you have taken that responsibility and you've turned it into a golden opportunity.
You know, I think that, you know, in days of yore, people used to look at their bartender as a kind of psychologist. And I think that that changed for a little while in the 70s and 80s, where they were just kind of fancy drink makers. But I do think that that's coming back. But, Gary, I have to tell you, my favorite part about bartending is when you're the bartender and you're a five, you become an eight.
Yeah, and as far as the rating from the opposite sex.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
That's
even
amazing.
More power from the mahogany.
You know, I have to say the idea of the restaurant, especially, and chain restaurants don't do this as well. So with individual operators, if you're a restaurant and you have the good fortune to have a bar, or if you're just a bar, that bar can be a locus of community. You know, in a world where we shop at the supermarkets and we buy our clothes from big companies and you go to the Walmart and you don't know anybody, the barman is someone to know, is a part of the community, a place where people come together and where you might strike up a conversation. And more than anybody else in our lives, the barman has license to strike up a conversation with anyone. And that's a huge part of the responsibility. When we come back from the news, we're going to be talking more with Gary Regan, who's a columnist and author of many books on cocktails, inventor of a bitters, which we're going to talk about, which you can find. And we'll talk about that after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Gary Regan. He's the author of The Joy of Mixology, The Consummate Guide to the Bartender's Guide. He's author of the column The Cocktailian in the San Francisco Chronicle. He contributes to many publications. He's also written New Classic Cocktails, The Martini Companion, A Connoisseur's Guide, The Book of Bourbon, The Bourbon Companion, and The Martini, A Postcard Book of 28 Classic Cocktails and Recipes. So Gary knows what he's talking about with cocktails. He's in that echelon of Dale DeGroff and Audrey Saunders and all those folks that we always hearken back to. His website is ardentspirits.com. You can find that through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We were talking before the news about how the bartender has a unique social position in a restaurant. And I'm not talking about chain restaurants, and I'm not talking about making stuff with umbrellas in it that's the new corporate program that's being advertised on TV. I'm talking about real restaurants and real bars.
And real restaurants where your bartender is the same bartender for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years.
Mark and I started as bartenders, and, you know, we would hold on to our shifts. Like, I worked Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. Mark worked Thursday, Monday, Tuesday, and we always wanted those same shifts because people knew when we were working. And most people like me better than Mark, but some people like Mark better than me. But in addition to having that place of privilege in a community, some of that we're seeing a resurgence of, and some of that is because bartenders themselves are looking at the craft of what they do, which is the making of cocktails, and people are making old-fashioned cocktails. Gary, will you talk to us about the age of the fuzzy wuzzy woo and the fuzzy navel is sort of going by the wayside, and you're seeing more talented young bartenders who take a class like yours to learn how to make drinks with fresh ingredients, learn how to make old cocktails, sour mix with egg white and lemon juice and lime juice and simple syrup. What's going on with the drinks that are being made today?
It's a whole new world out there, guys. You know, the bartenders of the 21st century, they have armed themselves, it seems, or the best ones, they've armed themselves with a lot of knowledge in the classics, in how to make a martini, a Manhattan, a Rob Roy, a margarita, a sidecar. They've gotten all that down, but now they're taking it to a whole new level. I mean, these guys are using ingredients that my generation would never have thought of. Mm-hmm. You know, I see people. I had one class this year, made a drink with Ardbeg single malt scotch, very smoky, right, and strawberries and black pepper.
Interesting.
It was absolutely incredible. I have people using cilantro and sage and jasmine tea. I mean, all sorts of ingredients. They're even altering their methodology. I'm learning more from my students than they're ever learning from me, mm-hmm. believe me.
We had Kate Crater on recently from Food & Wine Magazine, and she talked about how, you know, using fresh juices was, you know, so 2005. In 2006, you have to be prepared to use all these new ingredients and really make cocktails new and interesting, as well as, you know, using the methodology of fresh juices and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I had one guy this year, he was using egg white in a cocktail, and he shook the cocktail without ice.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what are you doing? He said, that emulsifies the egg white better.
Mm-hmm.
Then you add the ice, and then you shake it again.
Yep.
Like, my God, I'm learning all the time. It's just incredible.
You know, there are two points that I want to use this as a jumping off point for. We see out in Jersey and as we go outside the major cities, I see some amazing places. I was in Belfast recently, which never had a cocktail history, where there's a guy named Hayden Lambert at the Merchant Hotel who has started a cocktail program in Belfast. Amazing cocktail program in Belfast, which was not notorious for having a lot of great food.
Right.
And But what we're seeing, in addition to the real cocktail bars that are opening, I'm seeing the advent of what Mark and I refer to as the martini bar, which is sort of the fake cocktail bar. And I, you know what? I don't want to criticize people for doing this. It's just I think they're missing the mark, though. When people open a cocktail bar, they call it a martini bar. First of all, if it's not gin and vermouth, it's not a martini. Or vodka and vermouth, it's not a martini. It's a cocktail. But they'll open these bars that you have like a red cocktail or a
blue
cocktail.
You order by color instead of
or the cocktails aren't made with fresh ingredients and don't have any, you know, harkening back to history and they're all like Goldschlager and blue curacao and flavored vodka Have you seen these things?
Well, it's like making your pasta with Campbell soup as opposed
to we see a lot of that.
And how do you deal with that?
You know, there's nothing we can do about it.
But don't you just want to say, you know, why don't you... Sometimes I'll go to these bars, and if I'm traveling especially, I'll find myself one of these bars, and I'll give the guys a recipe. I'll say, can you make me this drink? And they'll make it for me. And, you know, it like they want to do it right. They're making an effort, but they're putting... I think the effort goes wrong. You can't use processed ingredient and just use cordials and things like that. I mean, do you agree with me on that?
I agree with you to a point. But the fact is, it's just like food in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
We have wonderful restaurants with chefs who go out of their way to buy the best fresh ingredients and to create new sauces, new flavors, blah, blah. And then we also have the place that uses lots of frozen food and lots of processed foods. And, you know, they come in a little less expensive, and it's the kind of food that's easier for the majority of people to A, afford, and B, you know, to people who aren't looking for depth and flavor. And then you've got the diner, and God bless the diner.
Yeah.
You know, with corned beef, hash, and eggs.
Well, and the best is when you find a diner with a bar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right, right. Seldom a good bar in a diner. You know, there's a place for everything and everyone.
I think that what you do through your columns and your writing and what we try to do through this radio show and you through your class is to just educate people that there is a difference between cocktails made, the ones that are made with just the processed ingredients and it's all out of a bottle and it's all shelf-stable.
Yeah.
That's like having the frozen food. I want to turn the discussion to an article. I don't know if you saw, there was a New York Post article that sort of was disparaging a new place in Manhattan that I like called Gin Lane. Have you been to Gin Lane?
No, I have not.
It's a lovely place with a cocktail list by our mutual friend Dale DeGroff, with a great cocktail list of about a dozen cocktails.
Uh-huh.
And those dozen cocktails are made very well. But the New York Post writer went in, and he ordered a daiquiri. And the daiquiri is not on the cocktail list, and these new young bartenders who've been trained in these 12 cocktails by Dale DeGroff made him a terrible daiquiri. And he said... The point of his article was if you have a bar, even if it's a new bar, and they can't make a daiquiri and they can't make a scotch and soda well balanced and they can't make a good margarita, you have no business having a cocktail list with, you know, a blood and sand and maybe some specialty and fresh ingredients. And I disagree with that. I think, you know, in a perfect world where we had, you know, a cadre, a legion of these experienced bartenders, you could expect to have, you would want to have an experienced bartender in every bar, and we want to have that. But I think that just because you don't have a lot of broadly experienced bartenders, you shouldn't be prohibited from having a cocktail list that's adventurous, and that's where we're going to get the bartenders of tomorrow.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have a bit of a reservation because I just wonder if these 12 cocktails are all these bartenders know how to do, and if they do that well, then that's fine. But I hesitate. I'm wondering how they will ever progress in the craft without having a knowledge of the classics.
Well, I think that there's one guy, the bar manager there, whose name escapes me at the moment. He is quite knowledgeable, but you know, it's a new place and there are young bartenders. And I'll be honest, every one of my bartenders is not a broadly experienced bartender. But they're learning and they're progressing, and I think that we can't be of the philosophy that unless you know everything about the basics, you can't make an adventurous drink.
And as long as a place has somebody there who's giving some guidance and teaching and can expand those horizons.
And the fact is, actually, when I say a knowledge of the classics, we're not talking many more than a dozen drinks here.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. And one of my problems with the New York Post article is I think he was talking about the whole breadth of the history of the old school New York bartender, which I wish we had a legion of, but we don't. Our guest is Gary Regan. He's a top author on cocktails and mixology in the country. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Gary Regan. Gary's the author of The Joy of Mixology and many other books on cocktails. He's the San Francisco Chronicle columnist. He writes The Cocktailian for them. Now, we were talking about cocktails before and the bartender's place in the world and where cocktails are in the world. Let's talk about something that all serious bartenders, like I've spoken with you about this in person, I've spoken with Audrey Saunders about this in person, and all the bartenders that work at the Pegu Club, Jim Meehan and just all these guys, and our friend Dale. One of the things that stymies guys like us and you who look for the old classic cocktails to recreate them and to have a broad-based knowledge of cocktails is sometimes when you look at those old cocktails, there are ingredients that aren't readily available
or
anymore.
Or don't exist anymore.
And you came across one of those ingredients and took matters into your own hands. You want to tell us about that?
The orange bitters, yeah. I couldn't find a brand that I was happy with.
But orange bitters used to be ubiquitous. Everywhere mm-hmm. you'd see orange bitters, right?
Absolutely, yeah. If you look at the old Waldorf Astoria bar book, there were way more cocktails that call for orange bitters than call for Angostura pre-prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I wonder if I can make some. And I found a recipe in a 1939 book, The Gentleman's Companion.
Oh, I love that
great book.
Yeah, great book. I made up Charles H. Baker Jr.'s orange bitters, and it was good, but it still lacked something. So I just fiddled around with the ingredients a few times, came up with my own orange bitters, and I used to keep Dale supplied when he was at the Rainbow Room.
That's Dale DeGroff, our friend who was one of the grandfathers of the cocktail in, sorry, Dale, about the grandfather grandfathers of the cocktail.
Yeah, he's so old.
Yeah, I know. But I can't keep up with him. I don't know about you, Gary.
No, me neither.
So you have Gary Regan's Orange Bitters number 6.
It's Regan's Orange Bitters number 6, yeah. It's made by the Sazerac Company.
And you can find it at BuffaloTrace.com,
yeah,
Buffalo, I think.
Yeah, the gift shop at Buffalo Trace.
We'll link you up on our website. We use this orange bitters at our bar. We modified a little bit. We add some other stuff to it as well, but it's a great orange bitters.
Gary,
I
have to ask you, I've heard the story, but what happened to bitters 1 through 5?
Oh, well, 1 through 3 were terrible. Number 4 was acceptable, but when I made up number 4 a second time, it didn't work, and I finally threw up my hands and gave the recipe to the guys at Sazerac, and they messed with it, and we decided it was number 6.
Well, now, other people, we make up a lot of ingredients that, I mean, we love that we have your orange bitters to use, but we make up a lot of ingredients as well, like contemporary soda, for instance, has... Almost all contemporary soda, not all, but almost all, has high fructose corn syrup, which I find that anything that has even a drop of high fructose corn syrup in it throws a cocktail off completely.
Uh-huh.
So we make up a lot of our own sodas, you know, a lot of our own soda syrups, and we use,
oh, cool.
Plain club soda to get the bubbles. Do you find that bartenders are making up their own ingredients? I want to go back to this guy who I didn't give enough credit to. This guy, Hayden Lambert, who's this guy at the Merchant Hotel in Belfast, who was out there alone in the woods in Belfast. He's the only guy in Northern Ireland making cocktails.
Right.
And he is doing a very similar thing, making a lot of his own tinctures, making a lot of his own syrups. Do you find bartenders
doing
that?
Oh, yeah. It's happening. I've had grapefruit bitters that were homemade by a bartender in San Francisco. There's a guy in New York making his own tonic water.
Yeah, that's really tough. That's the guy at Per Se.
That's exactly who it is. Over the world, people are making their own ingredients. And this is, again, something that hasn't been seen since the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm. Gary, I want you to talk to us just for a minute. Francis and I mentioned something called tinctures a lot. Can you tell everybody exactly what tinctures are and what they'd be used for?
Well, a tincture is just a concentrated liquid ingredient. So if you want to highlight, let's say, eucalyptus, you would infuse it into alcohol and bring it down so that it's very, very intense in flavor. So a tincture is just an intense liquid flavoring agent.
And we use them to kind of finish a cocktail. You might use a cinnamon tincture to finish off a cocktail if you wanted to highlight that note.
Hey, listen, this is for everybody out there. Whether you're a home bartender and you're interested in this kind of stuff, you should pick up Gary Regan's books for sure and get your hand on some bitters. Or if you're working in a restaurant, because we have a lot of restaurateurs who listen to the show and folks who are in the restaurant business who listen to the show. You know, the term bar chef often gets made fun of. But you know what? The things we've talked about today with Gary Regan, tinctures, flavors, balance, fresh ingredients, the difference between people who source fresh ingredients and people who use what's shelf-stable and available, that word bar chef, which was coined by Albert Trummer, who's a great Austrian bartender at a restaurant called Town in New York, it really does apply, and we really take it to heart, and so do you. And Gary Regan, you're doing a lot to educate people and to bring this back, and I just want to say thanks for doing that.
Oh, thank you, guys. That's nice of you to say, and thanks for having me on the show.
It's been terrific. We're going to direct people as to how to get your bitter and how to get your books. Again, it's Gary Regan at ardenspirits.com. Find him, though, through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Gary, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks again, Gary.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest was Gary Regan. Gary Regan is a tremendous author on cocktails. You got to go to a restaurant and check out a bunch of his books. His books are all great. He runs this program called Cocktails in the Country. If you're in the business and you want your bartenders to come to the next level, you can send them to Cocktails in the Country. He gets a lot of sponsorships. There are very few people that go out for a two-day seminar. We send our bartenders. Really great. Check it out. Okay.
And he's sponsored by a lot of these small liquor producers. There's an Irish whiskey called Napog Castle, which I've had in the past that's spectacular. That was one of the sponsors of this, and my bartender brought back and was like, look, I tasted this great Irish whiskey. I was like, yeah, turn around.
it's sitting behind
you on the shelf.
You might imagine from a restaurant that we own, we always have Guinness and we always have great Irish whiskey. I got Mark to promise that I could always buy those two things. We were talking about ingredients, and you know, ingredients are really important, and you build a cocktail ingredients, okay? And one of the things you should feel free to do is to go out in the supermarket or go to the farmer's market, and if you pick up anything from berries to mint to cilantro, go home and experiment with those real flavors and build your cocktail around those real flavors. And the other thing is, when you're buying liquors, we very rarely buy flavored alcoholic ingredients. I use vanilla vodka, and that's one of the few that I use, and I use vodka to infuse flavors myself into things. Like, so we'll put cloves in vodka to get a clove tincture, like very concentrated clove tincture. But, you know, raspberry vodka, I don't buy that kind of stuff.
Right.
To start with real ingredients. So if you're going to make a whiskey sour, use the whiskey we use for whiskey sours is rye most often. Use a good rye. Mm-hmm. You can't make a good whiskey sour from lousy ingredients.
And remember, when you're using blueberries and raspberries and things that you're taking from nature, they are never going to be as sweet as the thing, the shelf stable things you're buying off the shelf, which
right,
are
they're not as sugary, but they're more blueberry-y.
Which are artificial
blueberry-y.
You may need to add some sugar, some simple syrup or something like that.
Hey,
don't be afraid to do that, but you it will never be as sweet as the items that you buy off the shelf.
Hey, for those in Jersey, you know, in Jersey we produce Applejack from the Laird's company. There's a special ingredient I want you to look for. It's not available in every state, but Laird's Bottled in Bond apple brandy.
It's
if
got
you
a black
find
stripe
it,
right on the front label.
50 proof, it says bottled in bond, and that's a great way to start with whiskey-based drinks. Of course, it's more apple-y. And unlike Applejack, which is not 100% apple spirits, Bottled in Bond apple brandy is by Laird's. Check it out. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.